Ghostbusters!
This is Retro Asylum, the UK's number one retro gaming podcast show.
Hello and welcome to episode 56 of the Retro Asylum podcast. My name is Mr. Sid and I will be your host today. So today's episode is going to be the third in the series of My 8-Bit Life and I'm really looking forward to this one. As this is the Halloween edition of the podcast, it's very fitting that we'll be talking about a developer that has made some of the scariest games ever made. For those of you who have not heard of My 8-Bit Life before, essentially it is a chance to look at the life and career of a certain 8-bit game music composer. So it's a mixture of me telling the story of their career and playing some of their music throughout. I think the previous two of Matthew Cannon and David Whittaker have gone really well and I've had some really good feedback. But this time I wanted to raise the bar a little bit more and add even more insight and research into the show. This episode will focus on the life and career of Paul Norman, the legendary programmer and musician behind classics such as Forbidden Forest and Aztec Challenge. A while back, I contacted Paul because I really wanted to make a special podcast about him. He really kindly agreed to help us out and answer a couple of questions. Hopefully, this extra level of research will be apparent and you will enjoy finding out all about Paul. So before I move on to the main feature, I will tell you guys what I've been up to. Most of my gaming time has been taken up playing two games in particular. On my Amiga, I've been dedicating a lot of time to Premier Manager. Those of you who know me will know how much I love my footy games. I picked up a mint copy from eBay for 99p a while back, which is a bit of a bargain. Back in the day, me and a mate would spend hours upon hours on Premier Manager, trying to manage our way from the bottom rung of English football in the conference, right up to the Premier League. It's 20 years old now, and to this day, it's still so damn playable and addictive. I've been grabbing 20 minutes here and there on it, and I've really enjoyed playing this game. It's definitely up there in my top 10 games ever. On the subject of Amiga games, I've done a bit of a U-turn on this one. Over the last month or so, every single game that I've bought had a faulty floppy disk. You know, none more annoying than getting halfway through Monkey Island 2, only to realise that disk 8 didn't work. You know, it's a complete waste of money, and it renders the game useless, and this issue is really starting to take the fun out of it for me. So I've given in and brought myself an SD card hard drive. It came preloaded with 4GB worth of WHD load Amiga games. They can all be played on the standard Amiga 1200 with no need for any extra RAM. The card also includes every single CD32 and AGA game that all work flawlessly. Now I can enjoy all of these games on the original hardware at a pricely sum of £30. Anyone who is interested in knowing where I got this device from, send me a message via the Retro Asylum forum or Twitter and I will point you in the direction of the seller. As this one doesn't require any extra RAM and it plays CD32 games, it seems like a really good one to have. Thank you. The second game I've been playing is called The Dig. Now, where do I start with The Dig? I have so many compliments to pay this game. Growing up with the Amiga, point-and-click adventure games were, and still are, my absolute favourite genre of video game. The story, the challenge, the sense of achievement, they have it all. Up until a few weeks ago, I thought I'd play pretty much every point-and-click game, though that was until Andreas Wunder from Twitter mentioned a game called The Dig. I'd never heard of it, so I was really excited to find out more. I was going to play The Dig via emulation, until I found out it was on Steam for a measly sum of $2.99. Steam is a great way to play this type of game, and at that price you can't complain. Lots of other LucasArts games have been released via Steam, so I'd highly recommend checking out the others. I won't say any more about The Dig, as next week's podcast is out on Friday the 8th, is all about point-and-click adventure games. It will be packed full of community members talking about their memories and favourite point-and-click games. So now on to some site news and announcements. First up, Etsy have released a range of USB keyboards. These keyboards are essentially an old computer with a USB connection that can be connected to a PC, for example. The ultimate retro indulgence. The keyboards can then be used for everyday tasks like surfing the net or enhancing authenticity of running emulators. There's a fair amount available, such as Commodore 64, a few ZX Spectrums and an Acorn Electron. Prices start from £99, so they're not cheap, but there's something pretty cool about controlling a modern computer, an old machine. We have also recently put some news up about a couple of new C64 games. The fact that developers are still making games for the C64 is staggering, and the quality of these new games is mind-blowing. How the hell they managed to get these games out of the humble C64 is beyond me. If you haven't already, check out Bomberland by RGCD and Super Breadbox by Paul Collar. These new games are being released as digital downloads, be used with an emulator, and also as physical cartridges to be used on an actual C64. In most instances, the cartridge comes in really nice packaging, and it really does remind me of, you know, like the bedroom programmers from back in the day. They've got no deadlines, no red tape, they can just make these amazing games. Next, I wanted to give a shout out to a couple of new reviewers we have on the site. Both guys have been writing some amazing articles for the homepage, and it's great to have them on board. First up, there is Danny Major, aka Guy Fawkes Retro. Those of you on Twitter will know Danny. He's a big Amiga fan and a really good writer. Check out Danny's great reviews for Alien Breeze and Phantasy Star on the Retro Asylum site. Secondly is Steve, aka Press Play on Tape. Again, Steve is active on Twitter and recently met the Retro Asylum team at Play Expo in Manchester. Check out his fantastic recent review of C64 Anabolt by Paul Collar. Steve also managed to bag an interview with Paul Collar, which is now up on the Retro Asylum site. I will link to the interview in the show notes. It's really good to have these talented and enthusiastic writers involved with the site, so welcome aboard, guys. We are also giving away another amazing prize. November's competition is to win a ZX Spectrum. It comes with a few games, joystick, light gun, manuals, and all the leads. All you have to do to win this great prize is visit the Retro Asylum Facebook page, find the competition post, and then like, comment, and share it. You will then automatically be entered into the prize draw. The winner will be chosen by random at the end of the month. So good luck. Next up, we have the RA Q&A section of the podcast. This is where our community can ask us questions and we can answer them on the podcast. First up, John Kay asked what my favourite point-and-click adventure game is. Now that's a tough question because there are so many great ones. I won't say too much on this as next week's podcast is on this subject, but I would probably say Beneath a Steel Sky. For me, it took all of the best bits from the previous games in the genre and moulded them together into a visual masterpiece. I loved the comic book style graphics, the humour and the story. For me, it was all spot on. But as I said, this is a really tough question, and games like Monkey Island and Indiana Jones Fate of Atlantis are right up there. It was just that Beneath a Steel Sky just had a little bit something extra for me. My second question is from Aaron White, and he asked me what my favourite Amiga game of all time is. Now once again, this is a really tough question. Those of you who know me won't be surprised to hear that it's probably Sensible Soccer. I'm basing the answer to this question on the fact that Sensible Soccer is the game that I keep coming back to time and time again, and I never get bored of it. I would much rather have a quick blast on this over the modern FIFA games. This would closely be followed by another football game, but this time a management one. Ultimate Soccer Manager took all of the best bits from Premier Manager and Championship Manager and added some fun bits into the mix. When in your office, you could check teletext the results, place bets at the bookies on your team losing, and offer bungs in player transfers. It didn't take itself too seriously. It's a great football management game. It's a lesser known Amiga game, but I would highly recommend giving it a go.
Passes to Morgan, passes to Gibson, oh, it's in the back of the net, I don't believe it, let's go!
Finally, I just wanted to give a plug to next week's podcast. I'm afraid you're stuck with me again, but never fear, it won't just be me rambling on for an hour. The podcast is all about a genre of game that isn't covered much on the Retro Asylum podcast, and that is point-and-click adventure games. I give a brief history of the genre, and there will be loads of amazing community members who have their say on what their favourite point-and-click game is and their memories of it. It has been really good to involve our community and listeners, and I hope you enjoy the episode. It should be really good.
This is Uniforix, and you're listening to the RetroAsylum.com podcast. Why not drop by the forums and let us know your retro gaming experiences?
So now, let's get on with the main feature of the podcast. This episode is all about someone who had a massive impact on my childhood, gaming life, and some of my fondest memories are of playing his games on the Commodore 64. He rewrote the rule book and raised the bar, an absolute 8-bit legend. Paul Norman, step forward. This is your 8-bit life. Paul Norman was born in Washington, D.C. in 1951. At the age of 13, he was playing guitar and throughout the 60s and 70s was a member of various bands. To make a living, he was gigging at clubs on the Sunset Strip, touring and generally writing and composing music. The disco music scene was killing off live bands, and at that time, Paul stumbled across a VIC-20 in a music store. He learned the basic programming language quickly, and whilst at the age of 28, saw an advert looking for a games programmer in a shop window. The company was a small one called Synchro, run by two guys who started a small shop to make games for the Apple II, VIC-20, and the newly released Commodore 64. For his interview, he made an Asteroids-type game using BASIC. They were impressed, and Paul had his first job. The money he was paid for the Asteroids game just about covered the 50-mile car rental trip he needed to make to do it. On Paul's first day at Synchro, he was handed a C64 and asked if he knew machine language 6502. He had never seen a C64 before or even heard of Machine Code 6502. His Asteroids game had been programmed so well and ran so fast, it looked like it had been programmed in Machine Code, not BASIC, and he simply replied, "Yeah, I do." So there he was in a new job, having to program on a new machine in a new code he didn't know. All of this with the pressure to create a hit game. Later this day, Paul's boss came up to his desk and said, "Make us a game in the woods with an archer." This was the beginning of the making of Forbidden Forest. 3 months into the development, the small company went bust. To pay debts, Synchro were forced to sell its assets. A company called Cosme were there buying up all the office furniture and computer equipment. They got to Paul's desk and stopped. He was there busy working on Forbidden Forest, oblivious to what was going on around him, his head deep in this newly learnt programming code. The guy from Cosme got chatting to Paul and asked him what he was working on. He instantly hired Paul on the spot and brought the rights to this exciting new game Paul was working on. American company Cosme were just starting up their games group and were started by a couple of guys who had established European market ties for cheap audio cassettes made in Asia. As their business grew, they started recruiting programmers to make their own games. Here are Paul's memories on this first meeting with Cosme. "When I previewed Forest at the first meeting, there was an audible gasp when the little archer started running. My simple trick of moving 2 sprite trees a little slower in the background to simulate 3D seemed to be effective. They also liked the blood splatter. These elements seemed natural and necessary to me, so I was surprised to hear that such things were state of the art at the time." At the time, Cosme didn't even have an office, so Paul was working from home. This suited his style of work, as he was away from the business distractions and could get his head down. Now, back in the early days of programming, it was pretty normal for the programmer to also compose the music for the game. What made Paul so special is that he was extremely talented in both areas. He really did push the SID chip to its limits and made it sing. Let's not forget, at this point, the SID was a newish piece of technology that had not been explored fully, which makes what Paul did even more impressive. So at this point, Paul was right in the midst of programming his first game, Forbidden Forest, for Cosme. I would now like to play for you the soundtrack for the game. One thing you'll notice about Paul's music is like a film, different pieces of music for each scene or part of the level. Each piece is pretty short, so I'll play for you now the soundtrack for Forbidden Forest. Turn up the volume and enjoy. So that was Forbidden Forest there on the Commodore 64. You have to remember that back in 1984, the Commodore 64 was a new piece of hardware. Programmers in the early 90s had the benefit of years and years of techniques that had been found out to make games run, look and sound better, but Paul had none of this. He was starting from scratch, which in my mind made what he achieved on Forbidden Forest even more staggering. It's a better game than some that came out nearly 10 years after it on the same system, Paul's influence on the gaming scene cannot be underestimated, and he was a true pioneer of 8-bit video games. As Forbidden Forest starts, the credits appear on the screen, and a flying monster in the distance is getting slowly closer as the tension builds. There's eerily no music at this point. It starts as soon as you press fire. You play an archer, and you go from left to right and must kill with your bow and arrow a series of monsters. These include giant spiders, killer bees, and mutant frogs. There's lots of blood and some really gruesome sound effects. As a youngster, I was genuinely scared of this game, and it felt like you were watching a horror movie. Back in the 80s, I'd never heard or seen anything like this come out of a C64. Paul states that the whole idea behind Forbidden Forest was to create a movie experience, and he certainly achieved that. So by the time Forbidden Forest was released, it was selling 100,000 copies worldwide. Paul says about this time of his career, "I had no rules to follow, and there were no inhibitions. As always, I treated myself as the audience and did whatever I could to excite and surprise myself. One technique was to write complete action sections with lots of random variables without checking each step along the way. I would then run it to experience the whole scene as the viewer instead of the creator. Naturally, things didn't work a lot of the time, but when they mostly did, this was as close as I could come to an outside perspective." So, riding high on the success of Forbidden Forest, Paul started programming his second game, Aztec Challenge. Here are Paul's memories of Aztec Challenge. Aztec was a game originally created by another Cosmi programmer before my arrival. It was much like Mario Brothers platformer. I was asked if I could do a port to the C64, since Forest was finished and I hadn't started another. For one reason or another, one being that it was such a loose-knit organisation, I went off and made a completely new game from scratch that in no way resembled the first, except for the title. The ideas that arose as the game developed were suggested by movies about ancient tribes from South America to Greece. So many B-movies of past cultures included scenes where the hero has to run some sort of gauntlet of arrows, spears, and alligators. Released in 1984, Aztec Challenge is another game I remember really fondly from my childhood. I first played it around a mate's house and was hooked. Essentially, a set of mini-games. You play an Aztec slave, and you must make your way through a series of deadly games and puzzles in the temple complex. Each game gets progressively harder, and the amazing music suits the game perfectly. It gets faster as the game gets harder, which adds tension. The first level sees you running towards a pyramid in the distance. Enemies on the left and the right are throwing spears across your path, so you must either duck or jump. Sounds easy, doesn't it? But the closer you get, the faster the arrows come at you, and the faster the music gets. If you make the slightest mistake, you go back to the beginning. It's immensely frustrating, but somehow makes you want to come back for another go. But really, it's the soundtrack that is just so damn memorable. Again, similar to Forbidden Forest, it just works so well with the game. You feel like you're part of a movie. So here it is, the legendary music for Aztec Challenge on the Commodore 64. So that was the music from Aztec Challenge there. If you haven't, then I strongly suggest that you give Aztec Challenge a go. The gameplay stands up really well to this day and is really addictive. Paul reportedly really wanted to release Aztec Challenge for the Atari 2600, but had to abandon the project due to the technical limitations of that machine. Due to the huge popularity of graphic adventure games throughout Europe, Paul's third game was created in 1984. That game was called Caverns of Kafka, which was a platform-style adventure game. Set in a series of caverns, the great Egyptian emperor Kafka was buried in his tomb at the bottom of a cavern with his entire treasure hoard. And you're the guy who wants to take it all for himself. First things first, you've got to crack open his tomb by finding 5 seals and putting them in the door. It's easy to get into and conceptually really innovative. The closer you get to the treasure, the louder the music gets in the background. A really clever little touch that once again adds drama and tension to the gameplay. Unfortunately, Caverns of Kafka is slightly let down by some questionable collision detection and a few random bugs. But hey, it's a good game that dared to do something different, so it should be applauded for that. Here is a selection of music for Caverns of Kafka on the C64. That was a selection of music there taken from Caverns of Kafka on the Commodore 64. Here are Paul's thoughts on his third game. Caverns of Kafka had a very similar beginning to Aztec. In fact, not only did I create an entirely different game than the original, but pushed the joystick limits even further. Since the hero was climbing around an underground cavern collecting things, all this and more with a joystick capable of 8 positions. And 1 fire button. I must have really enjoyed working out those little problems. The following year, Paul was starting to experiment with how far the humble C64 could be pushed, just as he always had done, constantly trying to think of new original ideas. TV shows like Airwolf were really popular in the 80s, so Paul decided to make the world's first ever helicopter simulator called Super Huey. There were already lots of flight simulators available, but Paul thought that helicopter one would be much more fun. Here are Paul's thoughts on Super Huey. I hated the title, but the idea of a simulation of something real captured my interest, and in fact shaped most of my work for the remaining Cosme years. Cosme tells the story that they wanted a flight sim, and I didn't. Actually, I said, fine, but it has to be a helicopter. This accurate simulator sold nearly 2 million units worldwide. I set about learning the mechanics of flying a chopper. Again, calling on the poor joystick to do double duty, I discovered an interesting symmetry between the two devices. A helicopter is operated by 2 sticks, one for going up and down, the other for tilting the rotor that achieves direction of flight. The joystick has 1 stick with 4 major directions. Just divide that in half and you have 2 chopper sticks. Anyway, because it was the first helicopter sim, and because choppers were becoming more and more popular in the media, the game took off. that was a little bit of music there taken from the helicopter flight simulator, Super Huey. Next up came a game, in my opinion, that is Paul's best work. He was tasked with creating a sequel to the popular Forbidden Forest. Whilst developing his sequel during 1985, Paul squeezed every single drop of memory and performance out of the little C64. It was bigger, longer, had more blood. Here are Paul's thoughts on creating Beyond the Forbidden Forest. Beyond the Forbidden Forest is like any sequel to a hit. Higher production values, but the original spirit is missing. You can't go home again. Don't look back. It's all true for me. It had bigger monsters with less charm and better archery. But the music was good, I think, and I'm really pleased with the fire-breathing Hydra. A full-screen animated four-headed dragon just wasn't being done in those days. To give you an idea of what doing graphics was like then, imagine having the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle now make 16 different, recognisable, coherent pictures just using those pieces. Again, Beyond the Forbidden Forest is a game that I remember playing loads as a child. It was even more scary than the original. It didn't stray too far from the original game. I thought it improved in lots of areas. The gameplay used Omnidimension 4D, which allowed the archer to move in and out of the foreground and background, as well as pass behind and in front of objects. He can even shoot towards and away from the screen. As time passes in the game, as while you are venturing around the forest, you will see the scene change from dawn, get darker, to noon, and then lighter to sunset. A great little touch, and yet another example of Paul's innovative thinking. While this game is fantastic, the new firing system is hard to master. You now have a little grey bar on either side of the screen. That's the height that you'll shoot your arrow to. It will change if you push or hold down the fire button while you're not moving. So if you are being chased by a monster, you have to get far enough in front to have time to adjust your aim height. In addition to the new firing system, the game introduces a new golden arrow system. In order to get to the second half of the game, you need to collect a minimum of 4 golden arrows. Defeating a boss will summon an orb from the heavens, and this orb will grant you the arrows. However, every 2 arrows can also be used to revive you if you are killed by a boss. Some players will want to revisit the first few bosses to store up on a lot of arrows to be used for extra lives in the second half of the game. Others will want to speedrun the game and immediately enter the second half upon scoring 4 arrows. I remember one enemy in particular that appeared from the shadows in the distance randomly every few seconds. When it appeared, you had to quickly adjust your aim and fire an arrow between its eyes. It had to be pixel perfect and I simply couldn't do it. So I sellotaped my fire button down and went out to play with my mates with the hope that when I got back, at some point while I was out, the monster would have succumbed to one of my arrows. I came in an hour or so later and it worked. I defeated the boss. Nowadays there would be a solution online, but back in the day, a little bit of lateral thinking did the trick. One area that really stood out for me was the spine-tingling title screen. It starts off, it's pitch black. The light flickers on and off to reveal the words Beyond the Forbidden Forest made out of tree branches. It looked amazing and coupled with the mind-blowing soundtrack really set the scene for the game. So here is the amazing soundtrack taken from Beyond the Forbidden Forest. soundtrack there from Beyond the Forbidden Forest, an absolute masterpiece of Sid music. So, after the success of all these games, Paul decided to take a break from adventure games and use his programming skills to a more pragmatic way. He developed a series of applications that people would find useful, such as a paint program, a desktop publishing program, and a print utility. These sold really well, indicating that there was a future for the practical side of the home computer. However, the C64 was at the limit of performance, and every single drop of memory had already been extracted. Apple and IBM computers were growing ever popular, so once again, Paul learnt a new programming language, 8088 assembly. In 1986, Super Huey 2 was Paul's next project. Bigger and better than the original, this helicopter flight sim struggled to make a huge impact on sales, as at the time, there were lots of other flight sim games available on the IBM, but the idea of simulations was growing more interesting to Paul. He had creative license and freedom to create simulation games that no one had ever heard of before. For example, the ill-named Chernobyl, in which you ran your own nuclear power plant, or the Cold War strategy game DEFCON 5. Here is a snippet of music taken from Chernobyl. Here are Paul's thoughts about this point in his career. Super Huey 2 was just Super Huey, and I had twice as long to work on it. However, as often with sequels, the feeling gets cooler and more detached, and it shows. Chernobyl was just a very interesting experience for me because I love science and scientific technology. As such, I started a game about a nuclear power plant. But after doing the research, I ended up with a pretty accurate simulation. An operator of a plant in Georgia wrote to me and said that he loved to go home after work and try to find different ways to blow up the reactor. I'm very proud that I provided a fictional outlet for him. The Middle East inspired a different type of simulator next. The President Is Missing cast the player as a CIA desk-bound operative who has to unravel the mystery of the president's kidnapping with other world leaders by using his computer to access all of the information and use his brain to put it together. Paul adds, "The interesting part of putting that together was that all the information used was as authentic as possible. Only names were changed to protect the guilty." The game won the prestigious Most Original Software Project awarded at CES that year. Then in 1989 came a hybrid of all Paul's favourite types of games. Navy SEAL was an adventure story and a simulation presented as a set of mini-games. Here are Paul's thoughts on Navy SEAL. I liked Navy SEAL. After leaving adventure games for a few years to do simulations like The President Is Missing and DEFCON 5, it was fun to go back to an action game. Also, by the time I knew pretty much everything that one could know about the C64, and so the animations, graphics and sound effects were very good for the time, and the gameplay had great variety. It's one of the few games I actually enjoy playing. At this time, towards the end of the 80s, games were moving to cartridges. The Apple and PC were now more affordable. Navy SEAL was a slick and fun game that really pushed the capabilities of the C64 to the limit. For Paul, it was now time to move on to more powerful machines. Paul then left Cosme and, in his own words, was becoming bored with programming and probably resented the vast sums of money his games were making for the company. He then started working for Tiger Media, a company that was pioneering the CD-ROM format for games. The next 2 years were spent experimenting with concepts for various formats such as the 3DO, CDI and CDTV, researching new cutting-edge ideas. Paul then released Murder Makes Strange Bedfellows for the PC. This comedy mystery game used live actor dialogue and a real music score. Paul was in his element, writing the script, recording with the actors, composing and recording the score. Here are Paul's thoughts on this point of his career. At the dawn of the PC, around 88, I was finishing The Present Is Missing and was going to do a port to the PC and the Amiga. Unfortunately, my relationship with Cosme was becoming strained and we parted company. After that, I joined some friends I had made along the way and started working in the CD-ROM market. We had guys who were inventing code for CD games, so I wrote scripts and music. I produced Strange Deadfellows. We didn't do that well commercially, but we broke ground on some new technology. These highlights must have seemed like a distant memory for Paul, as his next job saw him join Sega as a consultant and designer. Whilst at Sega, Paul witnessed the game industry changing. It was growing more corporate, revolving around money and targets. With this went originality from the games, and this was certainly a personal low point of Paul's career. This low got even lower when Paul was working as a producer for the Home Alone 2 game. His original concepts were ignored in favour of the pile of crap that we were left with. Paul says, "I proposed several ideas to that company, but was told we are here to entertain people, not educate them. I guess I was moving away from the traditional video game concept." Feeling disillusioned with the game industry, Paul then took a career change and started to work for the Discovery Channel as a video editor and musician. Here, he released a CD-ROM version of Carrier Fortress at Sea. This job took Paul all over the world, scoring videos. Paul then got heavily involved with online programming and still to this day as a developer and online consultant. Now, nearly 30 years since the release of Paul's first game, his legacy still lives on. There are fan sites dedicated to his games, homebrew remakes of his games for different systems, and musicians still remixing his tunes. Here is a remix of Aztec Challenge by Alexander Ney, released in 1996. We'll be right back. 2003, Paul himself revisited Aztec Challenge and released Aztec A Queen, which can be played within an internet browser. There was even a fan-made Atari Lynx version of Aztec Challenge, which also features the original music. I will link to these games within the show notes. So, that has been the 8-bit life of Paul Norman, a true legend and pioneer of computer game programming and SID composing. I would also like to give a massive shout out to Paul for agreeing to answer my questions, and I hope that our listeners have really seen the benefit of this added research. The only way to truly appreciate Paul's music and games is to play the real thing. So get yourself an actual C64, Paul's back catalogue of games, and crank up the volume on that CRT television. I just wanted to say a massive thank you for all our latest iTunes reviews. We now have 100, which is an amazing achievement. If you haven't yet, we would love it if you could leave the show a review. They really do keep us motivated and get us noticed more. So before I go, don't forget to listen in next Friday for the Point and Click podcast by yours truly. And if you want to find me on Twitter, my handle is at MrSidC64. So I will leave you now with another remix of one of Paul's tunes. This is Beyond the Forbidden Forest by Alexandra Ney. Enjoy, and catch you guys next Friday.